Mr. Lockhart. Then let us begin.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hello, and welcome to Sordid Cinema. It's just like last week, we got a full dance card. My name is Simon Howell. I'm joined, as always, by Mr. Ricky D.
Hey, what's up, Simon?
And rejoining us is Mr. Edgar Chaput.
Good evening, gentlemen.
As well as Mr. Patrick Murphy.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Oh, snap. All right. Are we ready? Are we ready for this?
I think so.
I guess we're going to have to be, aren't we?
But before we get into the review, we should just tell our listeners that we are now on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and you can also listen to the podcast over at our website, which would be GoombaStomp.com and or SordidCinema.com.
Yes. That would include, of course, The Lodgers, which is the Twin Peaks podcast that I co-host with the very talented Kate Rennebaum. We literally just recorded our second episode, and I'm very stoked about that. And as well as TV Roundtable, which I co-host with some other fine fellows. Yeah, we are building a little bit of a network. It's getting to be exciting. It's getting to be a little bit tough on my throat. But, you know, that's just how it goes sometimes.
And again, all the information will be included within the post for this very episode over at SordidCinema.com.
Fantastic. Yeah, I guess, is there anything else about, well, actually, I just did this on the other podcast as well. I wanted to briefly ask our guests where, even before we get into the, movie this week, we're talking about Gore Verbinski's A Cure for Wellness. Edgar, where are you writing these days?
Thanks for asking. Well, I write for a website called cutprintfilm.com. It's run by very nice people. They've been very generous with what they've allowed me to do over there. Movie reviews, some editorials. As for me, if anybody that was visiting Sound on Sight back in the day that enjoyed the Friday Noir article, that's actually moved over there. And I sometimes do these insanely long, and sometimes I regret them, but insanely long franchise retrospectives.
What do you mean by regret? Like, what was the last one you regretted?
The Star Trek one. Not because I don't like those movies. By and large, I think they're rather enjoyable. But there were 10 of them. And, you know, you have to watch them or rewatch them. You do a little bit of reading on them. Basically, the idea of what I do is that I watch the films and I sort of contextualize each and every one of them. Sort of, you know, what's the history of the franchise? Who's part of this franchise? Why is, you know, the fourth film the way they made it? You know, and what were the decisions made behind the scenes? So it's not just watching a couple films and writing like 500 words. It's like sometimes these things are two or three parters, and each part being like, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 words.
That does sound like it would be a format for regret. I mean, if I
would have regretted that immediately as soon as I realized I had to watch the Star Trek, the motion picture.
Wow.
As the very first one. Come on.
That one's actually not that bad. That's we were just chatting about this before we started recording. The bane of my existence is Star Trek Nemesis. Oof, man, that's not good.
But it's got your boy, Tom Hardy.
I like Tom Hardy, and he's okay in it, but I don't know. That one just really bummed me out. It's an ugly, ugly movie, too. God, that's an ugly film.
Well, you can check out, I guess, all of Edgar's Star Trek and other articles over at Cut Print Film. And anyone else want to mention any other works before we... I mean, any other recent works, rather, before we move on to our feature of the day?
I think if you're brave enough after you listen to this podcast, you can go read my review for A Cure for Wellness up on SordidCinema.com right now.
All right.
But you'll get a taste of that during this.
Oh, I think we're in for a good time. All right, well, no more ado then. Let's get into it with a clip from Gore Verbinski's A Cure for Wellness.
Life on this planet first came from water. We spent the first 9 months of our existence submerged. Our bodies mostly liquid. This sensory deprivation chamber simulates a return to that embryonic state. Think of it as a cleansing of the mind, as much as the body. Some patients experience increased heart rate. Visions, even primal memories. But rest assured, it's just the toxins leaving the system. Give yourself over completely to the process, and you will see the results.
You're back on Sorted Cinema. That was a clip from A Cure for Wellness, a 150-minute oddity courtesy of director Gore Verbinski and writer Justin Haythe. It stars Dane DeHaan, who you may recognize from such films as... Didn't he previously star in Antivirus? I was trying to remember this. As well as a host of other things. You may know him from just generally looking like a younger clone of Brad Dourif. Stars DeHaan as an ambitious employee at some sort of gigantic financial services corporation who ends up having to travel to Switzerland to retrieve the former head of the company for arcane reasons that aren't really particularly important. And once he gets there, things get really, really weird, and I don't think we should get into more than that right now. Jason Isaacs is also on hand as Dr. Heinrich Vollmer. And we'll get there too. I gather this film was the source of some frustration in this room. So, God, who should I start with? You know what, Patrick? You've got probably the freshest thoughts because you just got off the presses with review. So, why will this film require bravery?
Because it's essentially like a poison for your body.
Brutal.
It's exactly spells out. I walked away from this thinking like, oh God, that was pretty bad, but no more bad than anything else that I've seen, you know, that was stupid. And yet the more I thought about it, as I kept walking on, as the hours went on, this movie made me angrier and angrier. It kind of sucks you in. And I say this in my review that it's got this sort of candy coating with the visuals. The visuals could almost make this film coast by, but beneath that, there's just absolutely a rancid story going on here and just horrible construction of what I don't really know what they're trying to say. They start out trying to say one thing and then they completely betray that and go into something else, and it ends up absolutely ridiculous in the end. This kind of seeped into my brain and just sort of left me angry hours later. I'm still angry about it right now, and I saw this movie days ago.
Oh man, Edgar, are you also full of rage?
I'm not full of rage. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't love this movie, but I don't know. I'm getting the sneaking suspicion I might be the most positive one on tonight's show. I sort of liken it to Beautiful Train Wreck or Fascinating Train Wreck. It does look awesome. I kind of appreciated what struck me, I think, most particularly about this movie is that I felt like it was going for a style of filmmaking that you don't really see anymore, at least not in mainstream horror movies. I know the independent scene is pretty strong and the foreign language scene is pretty strong. And we all have seen a bunch of stuff at Fantasia, so we know that by now. But I think mainstream horror is pretty garbage right now. And this one sort of just decided to play the game a little differently. Decided to play the game maybe a little bit like things were done in those old Universal horror films. It's a little too long. I respect Dane DeHaan. I know he's a good actor. I don't think he's particularly good in this movie, though. And I agree that it has some interesting ideas, but by about the hour and a half mark, you sort of get the sense that it's maybe not quite certain what it wants to do with them anymore. And it's an hour too long, which is not good. But I didn't, honest to God, I did not leave the cinema room filled with rage or feeling like they had gypped me or anything. I still ended up kind of liking it, to be honest.
All right, how about you, Ricky? Where do you land?
I don't know. I kind of feel really bad because I made you guys watch the movie because it was my idea to review the movie. So here's the thing. So when I first saw the ad for the movie, I honest to God thought it was an ad for Shutter Island. Like, I was watching AMC, so I was like, oh, maybe it's the movie of the week, right? And then I was like, oh, it's not. Because, like, what's his face? Dane DeHaan looks and acts so similar to DiCaprio in that film. And just the general premise and the setting and whatnot, it reminded me a lot of Shutter Island. Only Shutter Island is actually a pretty decent movie. This yes. is, like, problematic. So the thing is that I, like, kind of wish we had a bit more gore. And I don't mean the director. I mean a bit, just a bit more gore.
There's plenty of him, too.
There's a lot of Gore Verbinski, and I like Gore Verbinski. I love The Ring. I think it's one of the greatest horror films ever made, although it's a remake. I love... he did another movie I like, but anyways.
But the what about the one with Johnny Depp there in the desert?
Rango was good.
Rango,
yeah.
Rango was good. Pirates of the Caribbean was okay. The first one, I really, really liked the first Pirates film. But you know, he's not a terrible director, and I kind of admired The Lone Ranger despite the fact that it was somewhat of a mess because there's elements of that movie, like specific scenes, that kind of like blew me away. The thing is that I went into this film really excited because I saw some incredible marketing for this film, mostly via Instagram, where they just did some brilliant trailers and promotional material and posters and whatnot, at least that I saw on Instagram. Like, I actually saw a poster with a quote from a critic that called it a near masterpiece. And Ooh. Yeah, and so, like, it's weird because the movie is all over the place because it moves from like a corporate thriller to like a psychological melodrama to like a full-on creep show, and there's a lot of psychosexual like underlining. I mean, like, we can talk about the eels, for example, how they're all over this film. I could have used a bit more goth, and again, I don't mean the actress Mia, although she is pretty good, because there are parts of the movie that I do really like, and I actually really do like the third act, and I'm sure you guys hate the third act, but I feel like the third act is the only, or specifically like the last 15-20 minutes, is the only time where I felt like the filmmakers weren't taking themselves too seriously. And I felt like the rest of the movie was just a bore. It was too long, it was too serious, and the main character, I don't think it has anything to do with the talent of the actor, or lack of talent of the actor, Dane DeHaan, because I think he's an okay actor. I think it's just the character and the direction. I think his character was just boring, and it's okay for a character to not be likable in a film. Like, you don't necessarily have to like the protagonist of a movie, but you still have to like to, say, hate the protagonist and or like something about them, not them as a person. But I just felt his character was really boring, and there was so much foreshadowing to the point where there wasn't much of a mystery. Not that there was much of a mystery to begin with, because it was obvious right away what was happening. But even the foreshadowing did not help whatsoever. And the last thing I'm going to say before Simon cuts in, I thought it was so funny because I was watching this at the movie theater on a Friday night. It was pretty packed. And there was one lady where she was like, I don't know, her. It was like she was shocked. It was like mind blowing that the water was making them sick. I'm like, did you not realize like 2 hours ago that he kept insisting that he drinks the water? She was nice. Amazed.
I love her already.
I know, right? Like, I could not stop laughing when the lady freaked out loud and started like going, oh my God, it's the water. I was like, no shit, lady.
They telegraphed every single surprise in that movie, every single surprise in that movie, like way, way ahead of time. And yet they still treated the revelation like it should be shocking.
Well, and yeah, I mean, like the whole man with the invisible, whatever you call it, like mask, like, you know, the main villain at the end, like you see his image in the photograph in the office when he first arrives at the spa, I guess I'm going to call it like the spa getaway. And so he walks into this office and the camera like lingers on the portrait for like a good minute, that, you know, there's a reason why the camera is stationary and focusing on that portrait, because clearly the portrait is going to give out a big clue for what's going to happen at the end of the film. And it was so obvious. Like, everything about this film was just, there was no surprise. And I can't wait to hear what Simon has to say, because I'm sure Simon loves this movie.
Yeah, you're all insane. No, okay, I didn't love this movie, but there was a lot I deeply admired about this movie. And I think something that you've all really undersold is how fucking weird this movie is. Like, and I mean that in a few different ways. This feels like, you know, Verbinski's doing another Pirates of the Caribbean pretty soon, isn't he? Is he doing, or rather, there is a new one.
He's directing it. He's just producing.
Oh, snap. Oh, well, yeah. This felt like, you know, some directors have this concept of like one for them, one for me. And this feels like I just did five for them. I'm going to cram five for me into one movie. And that's why the movie is so long. That's why it feels like it has like enough concepts for three movies and just like cram them into one space. There's so much about this movie that formally, stylistically, on a script level, on a character level, is just so completely un-Hollywood that I couldn't not admire. Like I couldn't help but admire it. And we can get into the particulars of that soon. But
just because a movie is not Hollywood does not mean it's a good movie. I'm not saying this movie is terrible. Like, I think, no. Patrick, from what I hear from the four of us, Patrick, you hate it the most. And yeah. Simon seems to like it the most. And Edgar and I are somewhere in between. But the thing is, like, there were specific moments where I couldn't help but notice the nod to Alfred Hitchcock and the nod to Dario Argento, specifically like Suspiria. But I also kept on wishing I was just watching a Mario Bava film. Like, Mario Bava is one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. If you've never watched his movies, start watching his movies. He's like one of the greatest. He used to be a cinematographer, so all of his movies look absolutely gorgeous. I kept thinking of a movie like Kill Baby Kill in terms of like the way it was like shot, the camera angles, the wide angle lenses, the actual like location, and also I guess you can think of something like The Shining. But I just didn't see enough originality in the movie, and I honestly thought that the main character was just like dull, and that was my main problem with the film, because you follow him around for 2.5 hours. Simon,
I didn't have any issue with him either, and I think that he has enough pluck and just enough strangeness to kind of, for, you know, he's definitely not the most like engaging protagonist ever, but I certainly didn't have an issue with him to the point where I was like weary of spending time with him. I mean, he does some stuff in this movie that's like, if you really start to parse it out, is really quite weird. Like, for example, this fixation that he develops on Hannah, this person of indeterminate age who could be anywhere from 12 to 120.
I have to ask. I'm so confused about this. Okay, so I was confused because there's one scene in this film where his character takes her out to a bar. And I was like, she honestly, like, I know she was in Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac, but in this film, she appears to be no older than 14 years old. So now maybe, spoilers, she's like 200 years old for all we know, according to the plot of this film.
But he doesn't know that.
But she looks like no older than 14.
Well,
he takes her.
Wait, wait. She was 16, 17. I thought she was 14.
She's so young. And he takes her out to a bar to get her drunk or something. He leaves her alone for 2 seconds. And the next thing you know, the guy from Terminator shows up. You know the guy that gets his heart ripped out in Terminator? Yeah. He shows up and he starts like sexually, I want to say sexually harassing her, but like dancing erotically with her on the dance floor. He's grinding her. And then meanwhile, the guy's across the street talking about God knows what. And I was just like so confused. And like, okay, I understand that her dad is into her and that's all pedophilia, but I kind of felt
is the main character a
pedophilia?
You're glossing over a whole movie here when you say that you understand that her dad is into her. Like, you're glossing over a ton. They never really, I mean,
hold on.
I'm not saying I agree with him and understand why he's into her. I'm just saying I understand that that's what the movie was trying to convey.
That's what I take issue with. I think that this movie doesn't convey anything that the ending ended up being. It had nothing to do with that almost for 2 hours. And then the last half an hour, you're like, what the hell? This movie does nothing but betray its own story.
Oh, I completely disagree. I will tell you what this movie is about before this podcast is over. But
well, what about the psychosexual significance of those eels, man?
The eels.
Yeah.
No, but I wanted to specifically talk about the bar, and I wanted to talk about that town, because I think one of the things that's truly strange about this movie, and I think this would even be strange in one of those older films you mentioned, Ricky, in any movie like this, you know, there's this town that sort of hovers, that sort of surrounds the castle where the spa is, where most of the movie takes place. And in any other movie of this sort, that town would be in on everything that's going on. Instead, there's just this, there's this bizarre Swiss town that's just at the base of this castle, full of like Swiss gutter punks who hang out with like this weird jukebox and like listen to Scandinavian pop and like molest children. It's like, what is going on?
They are kind of in on what's going on, yeah, because I mean,
they know of it.
They know of it, and they're not helping anyone that goes to this like resort. And like, let's not forget the ending of this film where the four corporate execs show up at the very last second, conveniently, right when the movie ends. And then I love the last shot, by the way, where it gets a freeze frame on him smiling like a maniac. That was fantastic. But that was a little like convenient.
Really? We're going to start poking holes in the plot of this movie? Like, we're going to be here all day.
I'm not even going to bother poking holes in the plot of this movie. But the problem is that it's like its themes constantly change. What it starts out as has nothing to do with how it finishes.
I disagree.
And I mean, it starts out as something like, okay, it's talking about life, right? It's talking about how people are working and they're getting sick. And it's trying to show you something, right? It's trying to show you something about living in modern society. Mm-hmm. And it's doing this with people, you know, in a contrast to these older people, I guess we could call them, these people that have lived for 200 years through the, you know, distilling the water in this place. And it abandons that completely for the end.
Wrong.
Like the ending becomes all about the girl and the dad and her dad. And it has nothing to do with any of the themes, like their little twisted relationship thing, which you don't even spend time with those two characters, by the way. So it's not powerful at all. It's just, no, you have one scene. There's one scene with Hannah and the doctor, and that's it.
There was a 5-minute dance scene. Okay.
when they got married. And
there was a beautiful wedding. We all got to witness the wedding.
That's the last half an hour. You took 2 hours to all of a sudden want to spend time with these two characters. Like, I didn't care about them. They were only in the movie in one scene together, like for 2 hours. What was the point?
Patrick's kind of right here. Thematically, the movie doesn't really tie up whatever it's addressing towards
the
end.
No, you're both wrong. I'm going to tell you what. I'm going to tell you. Are you ready?
Tell us. I'm ready.
You're ready? Okay. At first I agreed with you. I did agree with you at first, but then I gave it some thought. I think the first 45 minutes, you know, roughly an hour, does set up this metaphor that you think that what the movie is about really is this notion of modern life as an illness that requires a cure. And then perhaps that cure is itself not so great. But it kind of pivots from that, but I don't think it does so in a way that's inconsistent. I think what the movie is saying that, yes, modernity is terrible, but it is replacing things that are inherently worse. That is a theme that I think you can say carries on through the entire film. I don't think you can say it contradicts that.
I don't know.
I think you're probably onto something, Simon.
Yeah,
in fact,
did I just blow your mind a little bit?
My mind is completely fucked up now. But I think one of the things that I took away from the movie, and God knows how many things you can take away from this movie, good and bad, but is that, you know, we start off in this corporate world and, oh my goodness, this venture capitalist, what a bunch of, I mean, we know what's going on in the world these days and in the United States and this and that. So my God, isn't this terrible? And then we go to this beautiful, gorgeous place in the Swiss Alps where it's made very clear that most, if not all, of the, quote, patients, end quote, are people that have retired from that sort of a lifestyle. There's even a bit of banter between one of the British and somebody else, like, about them being bankers or whatnot. So I think they keep on hinting at the idea that these people who have, you know, made their money, they've been wealthy, we can be maybe led to assume that they come from the same world that the Dane DeHaan character is currently working in now. Who, by the way, he's constantly referring to Call New York, Call New York, Call New York. So they keep on calling back to where the movie started. And then you have Dr. Vollmer, I can't remember his name, and his daughter. And they're in it, just as the venture capitalists are in it for themselves, well, this mad scientist, who's kind of like a 1940s mad scientist, or baron, I should say, is taking advantage of these other evil people. So it's basically just evil people taking advantage of other evil people. I don't know.
How it ends. The last act has nothing to do with like business, New York, how you live your life. It becomes all about the sick little perversion. And it has nothing to do with that relates in no way to what had been going on in the first half.
Well, the last act really feels like a classic 1930s, 1940s Universal monster movie.
Yeah, except that it's out of nowhere. Like, it didn't fit at all into the first, you know, 1 hour, hour and a half of that movie.
Does anyone else think that Dane DeHaan needs to eat a sandwich and or two? Like, that dude is skinny, man.
Well, he's like early Leonardo DiCaprio skinny. Like, you know, Romeo and Juliet Leonardo DiCaprio skinny.
I'm telling you, man, you go back and watch Wise Blood, like, he really is a dead ringer for young Brad Dourif. Like, it's almost uncanny. Serious. Go guess that. Go do a Google image search, I promise you.
I want to ask you this. So we've been talking about the visuals, and of course, yes, there are some very pretty images throughout this. And yes, Gore Verbinski is like Terrence Malick-ish when he's hammering home his motifs, like reflection, 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 reflection. I get it. All right. You're supposed to be reflecting your lives. Or the dream stuff. All right. Teeth falling out. I get it. You're in a weakened state. Or the eels, like you keep bringing, like the eels are a dream. They're a symbol for virility or masculinity.
I can't imagine why.
He abandons. Did you guys not feel that he completely abandons the stylish filmmaking that sort of engulfed the first hour and a half of this film? The last half is not nearly as stylish, that he kind of lets the story and characters take over, only they were never really there, and he starts directing it more straight.
I actually do kind of agree with that, but I think it has more to do with he no longer gets to play with that sort of duality between modernity and the past. Like, you don't get the contrast of the city versus the spa, and you really settle into that location more. And so he kind of has less of an opportunity to toy with the interrelationship. But I actually kind of agree. It does become more of a plot machine as it goes on. But he does also get a little bit more gonzo. I mean, that's also when you get a truly gnarly sequence of dental surgery that I frankly had a difficult time watching, as did most of my audience.
Although,
and the eels, the tube with the eels too, was kind of rough.
But here's the thing, like, I kind of feel like the second act was staged and directed like a psychological horror film, but I never felt like the main actor was really tormented. Like, in some scenes, maybe like the scene you were just referring to, Simon, but for the majority of the film, like, he felt like he was still in control of his body and mind, despite the fact that he was in a car accident, to the point where he was actually able to take the girl out for drinks, you know? Like, it was a different kind of movie where something like, say, going back to Shutter Island, where you have the narrator who can't be trusted, and you don't know if what he sees is actually what's happening or what he tells you is actually what happens. Like, it's the narrator that you can't trust. And in this film, I felt like I could trust him every single step of the way. And maybe that's why I also kind of felt like his character was somewhat boring. And again, I'm not blaming the actor. I think it's the way his character was written and the way he was directed on screen. Again, I don't think it's a terrible movie, but I do think for a movie that's 2.5 hours long, that sort of crumbles in the last 15, 20 minutes, despite the fact that it is at least having fun. I do think that's a problem. And I can't go so far as to say that this is a great movie. I can't recommend this movie without caution. Like, my friend Jerry asked me, should I go see it? I'm like, well, look, all I can say is there were stretches where I was like really bored, because this movie is long. They could have condensed it easily into like 90 minutes. And the visuals are just not enough for this type of film. This is not like a David Lynch Mulholland Drive type of movie where it doesn't matter what's happening or if you can make heads or tails as to what's going on, because just visually, thematically, the music, the sound design and everything, and even the cast, the actors are just doing such a great job that it's interesting to just like sit there and gawk in awe at Mulholland Drive. Whereas this movie, like, it's still trying to play itself straight, like a classic Hollywood thriller, despite the fact that you say, Simon, it's bizarre for like a Hollywood film. I don't know. Is it really that bizarre? Like, I mean,
I think it totally is. I think specifically, like, the rambling structure of the movie is totally bizarre. Like, this does not feel like a traditional two-act or three-act story. This feels like it has these weird distended stretches.
This didn't hit the beats that a traditional horror movie, even something
that's
like
what I'm saying does. Yeah, like,
yeah, I didn't know where it was going to go next. It felt like kind of odd.
Well, I think
isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, that's a good thing. Yeah. And Edgar, I was going to say, like, for the first hour and a half, I found this movie to be the same way that you described it, as refreshing. I actually was thinking, like, I am really digging this. It's weird, but I'm totally digging it. It's just that last hour, they completely, that's what sunk the movie for me. And it sunk it for me so bad that I now hate the whole movie for kind of betraying me and making me like it at first.
So wait a second. So no one likes the movie, but you all like different parts of the movie.
Was machen Sie hier?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Was machen Sie hier? Sie haben ja nichts zu suchen.
Take it easy.
Macht's. It's all right. Mr. Lockhart, every time I turn around, you're somewhere you're not supposed to be.
I guess I'm lost. I'm just trying to find my way back to my room.
This is the restricted floor. There are signs everywhere. Surely you didn't just wander down here by accident. What is it exactly that you are looking for?
I had a problem with my tooth.
What tooth?
Actually, it's feeling much better if you could just point me in the direction of my room.
Nonsense. We can't let you get an infection. You must let us take care of you. After all, that's why you're here.
Right.
I don't hate the movie. I can't say I hate the movie. I don't think it's a terrible film. It's the kind of movie that I would never really watch again, and I think it has a lot to do with the fact that I was bored for a good, say, 30% of the film.
But I do find it fascinating that, like, Patrick is praising the first 90 minutes, and you are praising the more sort of hammerish.
Oh yeah. Because I feel like the last 30 minutes of the movie, despite the fact that it loses itself thematically or in trying to address whatever the hell it's trying to address, I thought it was the director and the cast were at least having fun. And I felt that enthusiasm and that passion on screen. Whereas, like, the first 30 minutes, it felt stale, boring, mind you. The middle act was fine. But I just thought overall, like, it just didn't really win me over. I mean, there's nothing I can say or you can say to change the fact that I just wasn't entertained in watching this film. So from a viewpoint of looking at it as a form of entertainment, it didn't really entertain me for the full 2.5 hours. And looking at it from an artistic point of view, there are things I can praise, like, for example, the visuals, which, you know, let's not forget, this is the same cinematographer who worked on The Ring, which, again, is one of the greatest horror films ever made. So there's clearly things I like about it. I hated the score. That's what I hated, because I thought there was this one moment in the middle act where Dane DeHaan's character is running up the stairs. He's not even running up the stairs. He's, like, walking up the stairs, and they have this loud music just for no reason. Like, there isn't even anyone chasing him. It was like they were trying to build up this suspense and put the audience at the edge of their seat through the soundtrack, which sucked. And, like, let's be honest. In most movies, it's usually the sound design and the soundtrack that makes you feel at unease, right? But in this movie, I thought the score was just terrible. It was overbearing. It was too loud at times. It just wasn't doing what it should have been doing. I mean, we always talk about how it's always scarier to keep things off camera, keep things hidden in the shadows, you know, not be afraid to have a bit of silence here and there. This movie did none of that. It wasn't scary. It wasn't creepy. Yeah, there was one scene where they put a drill into the guy's mouth, but, you know, just go watch the dentist. Like, I mean, that just wasn't enough for me to say that I was creeped out, scared, or...
Wait, this movie had a middle act?
Yeah, I know. I don't know what it is.
I'm still stuck on that.
I think it definitely has a first act and a last act, but I don't really know what that middle act is.
Yeah, it had like three middle acts.
What do you guys think of the tank sequence? Oh, I just call it the tank, the chamber under the water sequence. I thought that was kind of cool, actually. This whole idea of, obviously, the Dr. Vollmer is using it to sort of purify the water. Not purify, I don't know what the fuck he's doing, extracting something from their bodies. But
right.
They're stealing it, there you go. But I thought that was kind of interesting, that concept of, you know, letting the water, you know, soothe you. And then all of a sudden he's hallucinating these dildos all over the place, the eels all over the place. And what did you guys think of that sequence?
I mean, there's a lot. That's actually that whole sequence where he's in the water tank and then there are nurses like basically having sex with each other for no good reason. That was like another example of like that's a little bit of world building that like I can't imagine other movies would have made time for. Like the fact that there's like this entire level of like bizarre sexual relations going on in like an otherwise seemingly quite sterile and sexless environment.
Did you just use the word world building?
Right.
World like it building.
It tells you something about
world building. Because there's two supporting characters, two like nameless characters who have sex. That's world building?
Kind of, yeah.
Orderlies are kind of a character in the movie, period. Like, they all have this sort of Swedish, like, icy politeness going on. They're their own creepy character, in a sense. And that gave them a whole other facet.
Yeah, I agree.
Now they're creepy, weird, sexual pervert people.
Hey, let's not judge. I mean, let's judge them for the other stuff, like the incest and the eels. But I was going to say something else totally different about that. But I mean, more broadly, first of all, fuck Shutter Island. This is a better movie than Shutter Island.
Oh, second, God, no. Shutter Island rules. All right.
Second, like, and I think the main reason I enjoy this more than Shutter Island is because despite the fact that the movie is like quite ostensibly quite serious and quite dour, like I never got the feeling that it was self-serious. I don't know if that makes any sense, but the film had kind of a lightness to it. Like, it recognized how absurd it was. And maybe that has more to do with like with the fact that, you know, my viewing companion and I were just like openly laughing at different parts of the movie where no one else was. But I don't know. It didn't have that sort of portentousness that Shutter Island had, which is what really pissed me off about it.
I don't know about that. I think, like, see, that's the thing. Like, you guys say there wasn't three acts, and I think like there was, and I think a good portion of this movie does take itself way too seriously. I mean, we get like five, if not six, flashbacks to when he was a child and his dad commits suicide by jumping off the bridge. I mean, that's supposed to be a heavy moment. They're trying to make you feel something for this character who you don't even like to begin with and end up not liking. So I don't know. I kind of feel like the movie is all over the place, and that's not necessarily always a bad thing. Like, we've watched a lot of films where we've said, hey, the movie's all over the place, but it's a blast to watch because it's a complete mess. Like, who was it that said it's a train wreck, but a beautiful train wreck, you know? I don't know about calling it a beautiful train wreck. I guess, I don't know. It's just weird how we have completely different views of this film, because I honestly wish we had more of what we got in that final like 20-30 minutes. Like, I wanted to see more of the crazy deranged nurse doing like really strange things. I want to see more of Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, and the Invisible Man and the monster and like and I don't know, more scenes with the punks at the bar, like,
oh,
the townspeople.
Man,
like, I actually felt that the townspeople were far more interesting than the people who were living in the spa.
See, what? I would have been the complete opposite. I would have rather had more of the dreamy kind of first hour and a half, where I didn't really know what was going on, but it was all imagery. Everything was just being told in imagery, even though it was kind of hilarious how many times he cut to the same shot, oh, you know, over and over again of like them going down the spiral driveway. Like, okay, I get it. He was really, really pumping it in there. And that was kind of part of the fun, at just how much he beat you over the head with his visual motifs.
Right, I think the best early example of that was the sequence where he first sees Hannah, and they're kind of driving in a spiral formation down the mountain, and he's seeing her get further and further away, perhaps wondering if she's going to jump. That was like a pretty, again, not the most original sequence, but a pretty effective one.
Yeah.
You know what? There's one thing I don't really understand about the plot.
Really, just one?
Just one. Just one. The subplot with his mother, we see him, Dane DeHaan's character. He visits his mother early on.
Oh, yeah, this is super weird.
And then, how does it go? I saw it a few days ago, too. Maybe it's still getting a little bit hazy in my mind.
He leaves to go to Switzerland, and then there's a scene in which he's back in, I don't know, New York, wherever the hell he lives. And there's a scene with him and his mom, and his mom has passed away, and then he cremates her. And so I was, like, confused. Does this happen before, after, in between?
It happened after he visited her, but before the trip. That was the sense that I got. The right before he left for Switzerland, he had cremated his mother.
Because the movie seems to play it like she, you know, those that classic scene where, you know, if a loved one is in big trouble, like you can feel it. And that's when they have the car accident. And his mother seems to like wake up from a nightmare. And then we sort of cut to the morgue. I'm like, well, wait a minute. When did he go back to New York to the morgue? I couldn't figure that one out.
Well, that's why a lot of people think that he actually dies in a car accident and everything that happens afterwards doesn't actually happen, and or it's a dream. But I think that's a big, huge stretch, and I think it's really stupid. I just think the movie's oddly edited. It was a weird choice in the part of the director and the editor to include that specific scene after he gets hit by the car.
I think they're fairly clear with the little dancing woman, how the dancing woman is dreaming, and then later on when the girl picks her up, her eyes are opened. At first, I thought that was supposed to represent him, that he was going to be in some dream, but really it was about Hannah.
But he was going to turn into a little ballerina?
I thought it was like they were trying to say something, right? Like, hey, this whole thing is going to be for nothing because he's going to wake up at the end and it was all a dream.
I mean, if I had to interpret it, we're all correct in that it is a very, temporally speaking, where it's placed is very strange. It's by far the strangest editing choice in the movie, besides, you know, the movie not being half an hour shorter. If I had to, like, wager a guess thematically as to what it's doing, I think it's trying to hammer home the main character's loneliness. Like, I'm not even really sure that the mother actually does die. I think he is unconscious at that point of the film. Perhaps he's dreaming just that sequence, but you know, we've already seen him lose his father. When he leaves, he's told by his mother that he won't be coming back, or that he won't see her again. And the meaning of that is ambiguous. He says, "Of course I'll be back." Perhaps it's just a way to establish that these bonds are very tenuous and that this corporate life has left him very untethered. Or maybe it's just a weird fucking editing decision. I don't know. But it's like, it's another one of these things about this movie that's just a little bit off kilter and like has me still thinking about it, which is more than I can say for, you know, Shutter Island.
So you're telling me that this whole 2.5 hour long film isn't just a long anti-smoking ad?
There's also that. There is also that. Yet another phallic symbol in a movie full of them.
does he ever actually smoke a cigarette eventually? No, eh?
He does. In one scene where he ends up, he actually smokes indoor. It's funny, it's in the middle, another sort of funny decision, it's in the middle of this chase sequence, and he just kind of like, he finds a pack of cigarettes and he's just like, fuck it, I'm gonna smoke. He's inside being chased, and he's just so stressed that he's like, you know what, it's time to light up.
And yet they never go anywhere with that. They make such a point of him eating his Nicorette gum or whatever on the train and all along. And yet they go absolutely nowhere with the smoking.
It's
about the
way,
obsessive personality
of that. But it's also another way that they're drawing these parallels between the old world and the new. And, you know, he trades one bad habit for, you know, his previous bad habit. And then things get worse. Again, when you trade away the modernity, which is bad, you get the thing that's worse.
I don't know if that's the case, because then they would have showed him chain smoking at some point. He has that one cigarette and that's it. Like,
yeah, he has the one cigarette and then he gets his head drilled into and eels in his throat.
He should have had a cigarette in his mouth at the very end. That's what should have happened. When he was taking out everybody, he should have had a half-smoked cherry, you know, just dangling from his lips.
When he was taking out everybody, you make him sound like he's John Wick.
he kind of does go John Wick.
This is a prime example of how I think we have a movie in which a cinematographer tells the story better than the actual director and screenwriter. And so that's why I'm a little conflicted, because I love the visuals of this film. Like, I mean, Patrick, you talked about the reflections and thematically what that means. We could talk about the eels and how they have control and yet don't have control over the eels and all of these things. But I felt like the movie just visually was telling a story better than the actual characters. And I think that's a problem. Like, again, it's not a David Lynch film. Like, it's not like the characters were as interesting, mysterious, or bizarre as what you see in Twin Peaks.
They could have been, though. And instead, they just wasted it on stock stuff. You know, Jason Isaacs is a great actor, but they kind of just turn him into your typical villain. I mean, you knew it immediately. As soon as he starts speaking with a German accent, really, you knew it. But
yeah.
the guy just has the look. His blue eyes are kind of a little, just a little too gray. And that stare of his, even though he's super polite and he comes across as villainously friendly. Like, there's no other way to.
I absolutely love Jason Isaacs in this movie. I thought it was fantastic. I loved how good he was at almost sort of making even me believe that I'm just a doctor and I'm here to help you out. You know, what's wrong? You know, just sit in my chairs, you know, come into my parlor, said the spider to the fly. I thought he played that really, really well. Is it a bit on the predictable side? Sure. I sort of figured out what was going on. After a while as well, but you know, to me, that's a quality performance. But again, and I think I said something like this, like earlier in this, in our review, I like the old timey horror movies, and this, you know, old timey movies didn't have eels going down people's throats or, you know, drills piercing people's teeth. That's obviously a bit more modern, but I felt a lot of this, the editing, the cinematography, Jason Isaacs, I felt a lot of that harkened back to old school moody horror movies. Not quiet, just mood pieces, unsettling things.
Even the fact that the movie is too long feels like that in itself harkens back to 70s. So like, how many times do you revisit a 70s horror classic and then you find out it's 2.5 hours long and you get to a certain act and it's this could have been tightened up a lot. I feel like that happens all the time when I go back and watch some certain 70s horror movies.
What are you talking about? No, like maybe once, like Stanley Kubrick's The Shining or something. No way.
I don't mean the very top tier classics. I mean like the just under that. You know what I mean? Like you go back and watch movies that you remember as being pretty good. And then you watch them again. It's like, yeah, it is pretty good, but boy, does it ever drag.
I don't agree with that at all. All of the classic horror films that I'm staring at right now on my DVD shelf are all well within like under 2 hours.
Well, again, you're thinking of the crème de la crème. I'm talking about the movies that again were pretty good, pretty good actors, pretty good script, pretty good director. But again, like those older films do tend to drag. And I'm sorry, some of the weaker giallos drag like hell.
God, I disagree. I mean, first of all, we're not going to compare it to the weaker giallo films, but the best when it comes to giallo, like a lot, I just feel like those films are just a lot more fun to watch. They move so quick and there's better pacing and editing. And the thing about this, like you guys are making me like hate myself for not liking it more, but the more I think about it, I'm like, no, like the movie was too long.
Clearly we're not going to see eye to eye in this movie. But I don't know. Personally, as someone who's seen a lot of mediocre studio horror films over the last few years, maybe I'm overrating it for the novelty value of it being like genuinely quite strange. We haven't even mentioned some of the strangest aspects, like near the end of the film, Jason Isaacs smelling his daughter's genitalia. that was a little on the intense side. I'm sorry. But I mean, I don't know. I enjoy the feel of a studio director who usually plays very much by the book, getting to do a movie that's like a little bit wrong, just feels like misshapen and like it didn't have like a bunch of studio notes ironing it out, which would they maybe have made it a better movie? Maybe, but it wouldn't have been this movie.
Yeah, I will agree that I want to see him make more movies like this, guaranteed. I don't hate the movie. I don't think it's terrible. I think it's just okay. Like, I was just like, I think the thing is, Simon, it's not that we don't see eye to eye on the film. I just think that at the end of the day, you were more entertained than I was.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of agree with most of your assessment of the film. Although, for some reason, I'm the only one here that loves the final act, including that final shot, the freeze frame. I thought that was, like, fantastic.
A great last shot. I mean, something you were kind of hinting at before Edgar and Patrick was like, I think there's a really great casting coup here, which is like maybe you don't find Dane DeHaan to be the most charismatic lead figure, but he's great against Jason Isaacs because Isaacs has this air of professionalism and politeness, and he's a great villain because he has this air of uber competency. Where he's, you know, guiding you to your doom. And Dane DeHaan, contrarily, is kind of like frail and creepy. And, you know, it sort of messes with you on a subconscious level. You trust the wrong person.
Yeah. I can respect that.
I wouldn't call him creepy. He comes across as a creep, but not creepy in the sense that, like, you think he's going to stalk you and kill you. Just a creep in the sense that you just can't trust him because he's going to, like, steal your money.
Or, like, if you had a daughter, you wouldn't want her dating him.
That's more because he's a douchebag, though.
Oh, that's the word I was looking for.
No, you're probably just going to skin your cat.
There's a lot of old naked people in this film.
Yeah, that was also good.
That's awesome.
Yep.
That was awesome.
Floating around there, just letting it all hang out.
Yeah, they are floating around there. Yeah, in their little tanks there.
I have to say, one of the other, like, weirder visual motifs was, like, fat people swimming. There was a lot of that. It was, like, a very unusual visual for a Hollywood film.
Did you notice that all of those, the women that swam by in the foreground were the exact same woman over and over and over again, making the exact same stroke?
I did notice that.
I thought that was totally going to mean, like, yep, he's just dreaming. This whole thing's a dream. Yeah, it was the exact same. I kept watching them over and over and over again. It was the exact same woman making the exact same stroke.
Like, actually, this podcast has been a dream. You're awake. You're not even awake right now.
I can't remember who employed the term hammer-esque earlier, but man, in the climax, when Dr. Vollmer's, like, when he takes off his face, what is it, his skin? That was kind of awesome. That really made me think of the hammer.
Not just because of the way we had that big revelation and he starts ripping apart his face, but it's just the whole entire scene, like the candlelights and the fire in the background, and just the that was one specific scene where the actual score works beautifully. That reminds me of one of those classic horror films that I absolutely love. Yes. That was what I wanted more. I wanted to see more of that. And that's the thing, like, tonally, the film was all over the place. And when I think Patrick said that it kind of felt like the movie was just such a mess, I kind of felt like it was like the last... sorry, guys, I'm going to stick with three acts here. The third act, I kind of felt like he was trying to make one of those classic Hammer films. The middle act, I kind of felt he was being influenced or inspired by movies like Stanley Kubrick's films or Session 9 or movies like that, you know? And the opening, I was thinking of more like movies like In the Mouth of Madness or Frailty or some of those like earlier, like late 80s, early 90s horror films. And there was, of course, a touch of like Italian horror. I just prefer the second half of the film more than the first half of the film.
I mean, I was personally surprised at the lack of subtlety when Jason Isaacs reveals what he actually looks like and then Can't Feel My Face came on the soundtrack. I was like, guys, this is a little bit blatant.
Oh, in a movie filled with crazy things, I thought that probably was just the right choice. You know what I mean? Just hit the sweet spot.
There was nothing subtle in this movie at all. There were absolutely no subtleties. Like, oh, everything
actually,
beat
I disagree
you
with that, too.
With it.
I disagree with that, too.
You gotta be kidding me.
Yeah, just one thing. I did really love the touch of, like, earlier, like, quite a bit earlier in the film, actually, when Isaacs is dabbing his forehead for blood, and you think it's, like, a hint of the illness sort of secretly pervading this theoretically very healthy place, which it is, but then later finding out that it's literally because the seam of his face is falling off.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. Come on.
All right, cool. I'll give you that it was cool, but it just didn't, like, it didn't make sense in the context of the rest of the movie. That's all.
I'm not sure. I know as film critics, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on subtlety, and mostly with good reason. I like subtlety too, but I don't think, you know, I don't think this movie necessitated subtlety. I agree that it's not subtle, but I don't think it becomes a bad movie because of it necessarily.
I'm not saying that for sure. I found the first half to be enjoyable because it was so over the top visually. I loved that about it. I didn't need it to be subtle necessarily. And I'm certainly not criticizing it for being subtle. I found it hilarious at times how unsubtle it was. But it just didn't do it. I don't know. It kind of went back and forth as to what it was unsubtle with. In the beginning, it was the visuals. And in the end, it was the plot. And in the middle, I don't know. It was just kind of like jumped all over the place. And it was kind of a weird melding of those two things. And none of it worked.
Anyway, the movie's called The Cure for Wellness. Anything, any sort of last comments we may want to make before we wrap up?
I felt like I got stabbed in the back after seeing this movie. That's the way to. So if you like that, go see A Cure for Wellness.
I would actually strongly, especially for the visuals and for the gonzo aspects, I would strongly encourage people to go see it in cinema. Maybe go at, like, if you're a little bit wary about it, go like on Bargain Tuesday or something. Like, you won't pay as much, but try to see it on the big screen with the big sound.
I would say, yeah, I would recommend it for like a three beer Tuesday matinee, and like pace yourself because it's got 7 acts.
Yes. Yeah, Rick. Yeah, we still don't understand your 3-act structure there.
How does it have 7 acts?
It's got the one at the beginning and the one at the end and the 5 in the middle. What's complicated about this? Movie's called A Cure for Wellness. If you have opinions that line up or don't line up with any of ours, we'd love to hear from you. I would love to get other viewers.
Oh my God, mind blown. I actually just seriously thought about this right now on the spot. Because remember I was talking about the freeze frame, and I love the freeze frame so much.
Yeah.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong, but when he smiles at the end of the film and we get that freeze frame, does he not have all of his teeth?
He does have all of his teeth. Yeah. I thought
mind blown. Amazing.
Yeah.
Best shot of the movie, man. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
It just proves that the whole entire thing was a dream.
No, wait a second. No. Because after he had his teeth drilled out, you see him in another scene where he's kind of like sedated. He's under the drug or whatever. They go sit on the bench and she's all disappointed that he's not the guy that's going to get her out of there. And he has all his teeth there too. It's like they gave him fake teeth or something.
Mm.
Yeah, because everyone else, in theory, their teeth are all falling out. We see that giant jar of teeth, which is a great visual.
And yet they all have teeth in their mouths, so they've been given fake teeth or whatever.
Sorry, Ricky. It was a great last shot, though. Actually, now that I think about it, it kind of reminds me of the last shot of Sleepaway Camp. Except on a bike and with, you know, other things are different. Anyway, if you don't know, just watch Sleepaway Camp and you'll understand what I mean.
Screw that. Just watch the last 2 minutes.
No. Watch all of it. It's a great movie. You know, a good movie. Or, you know, a movie. Anyway, A Cure for Wellness is the movie. Thank you, Gore Verbinski, for making it and for making Patrick feel like he was stabbed in the back. I never leave movies thinking I was stabbed in the back. I think you watch movies too personally, Patrick.
This one did feel like a betrayal, I gotta tell you. I don't feel like that very often. I, you know, despite the last 2 weeks, I don't actually hate movies. I really do love them, but we've just run across a couple of bad. I like John Wick 2 way more than this. Let's put it that way.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. I guess very briefly, I want to hear from everyone. Are you on the Twitter machine, Edgar?
I am. I'm on Twitter at @OOH_pop.
All right. Ricky, of course, you run the Goomba Stomp Twitter. Is that all your Twitterness right now?
No, so you can find me over on Twitter at Goomba Stomp Mag, M-A-G at the end, and also Sorted Cinema. So there's two Twitter accounts. For the podcast, of course, you might want to follow the Sorted Cinema Twitter handle over at GoombaStomp.com and or SortedCinema.com. It's the same site, technically. We're on Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, Flipbook, Snapchat, you name it. And
are we actually on Snapchat?
I don't know, but I'm pretty sure we
Swipe
are
right.
Oh, no, that's Tinder.
There we go.
Yeah, we're on Tinder too. Grindr, you name it. And that's it. Look, visit our website, and if you're a gamer, check out our gaming podcast. We have the N Express podcast, which Patrick and I also host, and I guess that's it.
Fantastic. I'm on Twitter at Hollow Minds, but don't follow me because I'm just going to tell you about why you should be a socialist. And I guess, and Patrick, how about you?
You could probably find me if I am on Twitter under the @NExpressNintendo handle for the NExpress podcast.
Fantastic. And once again, thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back before too long. Bye-bye.
Something in the water?
At the bottom.
I don't see anything.
Did it hurt?
Can't remember.
Better that way.
I saw you. before. You a patient here? She's just so much younger than everyone else.
Director Vollmer says I'm a special case. What about you? Are you here for the cure?
No. Actually, I was just leaving.
No one ever leaves.
Can't control my fingers. Can't control my.